The Doctrine of Redemption Through Grace 167. The Orphic Egg. The universal germ, stirring within the egg of creation, established the worlds and generations by three gestures. It fashioned the souls of things according to virtue, the bodies of things according to beauty, and the laws by which souls and bodies are maintained according to the necessary. Together these comprise et work which is called the good. Chapter 8. The emission of aesthetics. Aesthetics is that branch of philosophy concerned primarily with the intrinsic nature of beauty, its place in the divine plan, and the processes whereby beauty can be created or caused to manifest where previously it did not exist in a tangible state. That beauty produces a profound effect upon the entire nature of man is too well established to be questioned. Just what constitutes beauty, however, and why it wields so profound an influence is still a subject of controversy. Is environment the basis of an aesthetic standard, that is, does the familiar become the standard of aesthetic propriety? In a limited sense this must be true. On the other hand, man has been surrounded for ages with such familiar themes as war, disease, and decay, yet he has never come to regard these as beautiful, at least not in his lucid moments. Beauty, declared the ancients, results from the harmonious correlation of parts. The spectacle of the mutual agreement of all the elements involved in a common pattern creates a pleasant reaction in the sensory organism of man. That the urge toward what man terms the beautiful is universally present in nature was also asserted. Certain natural processes were cited in support of this belief. For example, vines and creepers rapidly grow up to hide the gaunt outlines of a rotted tree, and flowers in profusion blanket the shell-torn fields of Flanders once made horrible by the unleashed fury of man. Standards of beauty vary with the evolutionary status of races and individuals. The preference displayed by the Nobile Iti of Hawaii for stoutness of figure proved rather embarrassing to the court of Queen Victoria. The hennaed whiskers of the Rajput gentry, while very chic in Rajputana, are a striking 169. 170 lectures on ancient philosophy. Incongruity to Western standards of aesthetics. The quaint African custom of dist ending the lips and ears by the insertion of loops of bone or pliable wood is productive of a type of beauty totally beyond our Occidental comprehension. Further more, though our poets wax eloquent over the graceful lines of a swan's neck, the Burmese belles, who achieve the literal effect by stretching their necks with iron rings, find our modern verse mongers strangely unresponsive to their charms. It is difficult, perhaps impossible, for the individual to view life with any aesthetic standard other than his own. If it were possible to analyze the sensory organism that can see symmetry in the bound and distorted foot of a Chinese lady, one great mystery of aesthetics would be well nigh solved. The gradual evolution of man's concept of beauty seemingly depends upon both the power of observation and the sense of proportion. For example, the child recapitulates, in some measure at least, the racial evolution of which it is a product. Children, while fond of drawing, are generally incapable of recognizing poor perspective, and among primitive types nearly all art is two-dimensional. When a child designs a crude little house the size of a postage stamp and draws a man beside it several inches high, it senses no inconsistency in the possibility of the man to enter the house. In a similar way, the little girl regards her doll as alive and intelligent, although well aware that its head is made of porcelain and its body of sawdust. Great battles are fought with little tin soldiers on a nursery floor, and both the little Chinchilla bear and wooden horse are endowed by their juvenile owner with all the qualities of their living prototypes. The sculptor of the Stone Age, probably likewise unaware of the crudity in his technique, evidently viewed his art as a striking reproduction of the person or principle he sought to portray. When the medieval artist drew upon canvas faces which were as expressionless as eggs, he endowed them, so he believed, with all the beauty and vividness of his model. The evolving standards of symmetry, however, have outgrown his ideal, making the products of his brush now valuable for their oddity rather than their merit. Thus, while we are able to estimate the inconsistencies of the past when contrasted with the apparent consistencies of the present, we are wholly unable to realize how inconsistent the present will appear in the light of future standards. Some may still recall the time when Dame Fashion decreed bustles and leg of mutton sleeves for milady, and when gentlemen had the creases pressed out of their trousers lest they be suspected of buying ready-made clothes. While all admit the revolutionary changes of fashion, the mental process that justifies these changes and ridicules that which it previously justified is more difficult of analysis. The average individual believes that beauty in style is established by the caprice of the modiste and fashionable tailor, who find it lucrative to cater to the love of novelty innate in human nature. While this may be the superficial explanation for these cycles of change, the definite trend of the centuries is produced by certain psychological tendencies. In discussing such problems of aesthetics as simplicity and complexity, a modern writer has arrived at some remarkable deductions. Simplicity has long been accepted as the chief prerequisite of beauty. This is definitely opposed to the barbaric tendency toward adornment. It is reasonably certain, for instance, that clothing, except in the most frigid zones, is the outgrowth of the desire for ornamentation rather than the dictate of utility. The theory is also now advanced that complexity is used to conceal weakness, and simplicity to reveal strength. The evolutionary trend of aesthetics is obviously toward simplicity, for complexity invariably creates the sense of discord by scattering the faculties of comprehension. Man originally conceived ornamentation as complementing his personal dignity. He considered adornment a setting wherein he might be shown to better advantage. Illustrative of the degree to which this element has eclipsed the personality is the story of two ladies watching a third go by wearing a very expensive ermine cloak. Turning to the second lady, the first remarked, "Did you see that magnificent cape that just passed by?" Thus, in the effort to be beautiful, humanity has become a race of mannequins, hopelessly enslaved to fads and styles which, if not actually, the mission of aesthetics. 171. 172 lectures on ancient philosophy. Detrimental, are at least unnecessary. Greek supremacy in aesthetics is based upon the fact that they achieved the objectification of the beautiful while at the same time preserving utter simplicity. Never did they permit principles and ideals to become involved in complicated forms of manifestation so that they were even partly obscured. In Greek art the idea was ever apparent, and with the objectification of that ideal labor forthwith ceased, for beauty was recognized to be a principle so elusive that it invariably escaped if the means to capture it were unduly stressed. Apropos of this truth is the saying that it requires two men to paint a great picture, the first is the artist, the second, a near friend whose duty it is to shoot the artist at the psychological moment. The plea of Greenwich Village, art for art's sake, while it expresses a theoretical ideal, is often misapplied. There is a tendency to produce technicians who become so skilled in the manipulation of various mediums that they overlook the fact that all mediums are useful simply for the expression of an idea. The great artist is not necessarily a great technician, he is rather a man with a great idea. It is a curious, but nevertheless noteworthy fact that those with the best knowledge of grammar and composition seldom write the best books. Those who become slaves to means or methods are prone to lose sight of ends. Words are sound mosaics which by their combinations create pictures in the mind of the one who hears them. It is the ability of the speaker to create this picture in the mind of his audience that is of prime importance. His greatness is measured by the sublimity of that picture. What words arc to the orator, pigments arc to the artist. Through their infinite combinations, eternal and intangible verities are expressed in a language comprehensible to the understanding soul. All the arts and sciences are such mediums of expression, fulfilling their purpose when they are developed not for their own sake but for the sake of those inner convictions which through them alone can be shadowed forth to become an impulse or urge in the external life. It is his own short-sightedness which invariably thwarts the ends of the technician mission of aesthetics. 173. Nishan. A certain thrill which accompanies the possession of an intricate and adequate mechanism of expression has a tendency to fascinate the mind and hold it as in a hypnotic spell. The fact that words, like colors, are susceptible of such a variety of combinations often intrigues the mind from pursuit of an ideal to lose itself in the maze of approaches to that ideal. The desirable knowledge of method is thus acquired, but the chief purpose has been frustrated, namely, arrival at the true goal. The result is a wasted life in the sense that self-expression has failed to be objectified to the ancients. The arts and sciences were all sacred to the gods, and upon being admitted to apprenticeship, the future craftsman dedicated whatever proficiency he might later acquire therein to the service or expression of eternal truths. Man studied that he might not only learn but that he might use intelligently. And what may be termed intelligent use? The answer is, a use that is beautiful, virtuous, and necessary, since these are the true characteristics of divinity. For God was regarded as the most beautiful, the most virtuous, and the most necessary of all things. In its truest sense, therefore, aesthetics may be considered a philosophic discipline by which the consciousness of man is equipped to estimate the degree of beauty, the degree of virtue, and the degree of utility inherent in the nature of an object. Also the power to discern how these qualities may be increased to ultimate perfection. The first work is to establish the nature of beauty, virtue, and utility in their most comprehensible sense. Before beauty is cognizable in other than its transitory and in consequential sense, the consciousness must be elevated to that level of rationality on which the principle of beauty exists, dissociated from the clumsy efforts of man to express its qualities. Upon the basis that only the beautiful is capable of recognizing the beautiful, the assumption of the philosophic life is regarded as indispensable to the recognition of the aesthetics of divinity. Socrates would have conceived beauty as expressing itself in the social fabric as utility and in the moral fabric as virtue. To be beautiful is the natural state of all that is good, in that good must manifest good, and beauty most adequately expresses.